is the Gramian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Gramian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, my friends, welcome. It is that dark disquiet of the web that you know as the Gramian Report, your voice of reason in an unreasonable world. And I am your mouth of the South, the mouth of America himself. In fact, Micah Hanks, welcome, my friends, to the Gramian Report. I tell you, it's been a really, really busy day for me. This is going to be my fourth live broadcast. I started out my day right around noontime, East Coast, joining Jason McClellan on a special edition of Open Mind Spacing Out program, where we remembered Philip Coppens and then went on to Eldon Taylor's Provocative Enlightenment program. And then after that, we did Jeff Belanger's 30-odd minutes. And here I am now in the bunker. I'm not alone, thank goodness. I tell you, I'd be losing my mind if I were having to do all this by myself. We've got a fantastic technician who is hanging in the underground with us tonight. Caleb Hanks, welcome to the program. How are you tonight?
Good. Good to be here, Micah.
Well, I'm very glad to have you here, dude. I tell you, because it's been one of those wild days, but we are testing an all-new interface here at the Gramian Report, and this is very exciting to me. You know, it's an independent operation here, and over the last couple of weeks, I've been working on everything from Indiegogo campaigns to updating our website. If you haven't checked out the new look the website has, GramianReport.com, boy, we are looking. And frankly, I think I speak for everyone here on the staff when I say this. We're looking and feeling better than ever before. If you haven't seen the new look, go check out www.gramianreport.com. If you're listening live tonight, you are already there, because this is one of the great new features. We are streaming live. We've kicked out our former host. We are now streaming live direct to the website. Thank you to the work of Caleb Hanks in not only getting our graphics together and our interfaces together and all this stuff and doing our audio tests. And he's been checking prior to airtime tonight. And of course, he's going to be checking throughout the program, no doubt, making sure everything is running as smoothly as possible. The kind of quality you've come to expect from the Gramian Report. Well, we've got that for you, and there's going to be even more of it to come in the following weeks. Have I not told you? It's going to get better. And this is only the tip of the iceberg, folks. You know, Caleb and I and Matt and Tyler Pittman, you know, and so many of the other folks who are involved with this program, you know, have really been working to increase not only what we provide to you and how much of it we provide, but also just the quality and the way that we do it. And so now, when you want to listen live to this program, you'll be able to go directly to GramianReport.com. We're going to have shows that are going to be uploaded to YouTube just as well, and you can follow the Micah Hanks YouTube channel and listen to all kinds of past programs. And, of course, then you're also going to be able to download them on your iTunes and things like that. The ways that you have preferred to listen in the past will all still be available for you. And speaking of the past, you know, we talk about time travel and all that sort of stuff on this program quite a bit. When you visit GramianReport.com, head over to Podcast and Radio on the top right-hand corner of the toolbar at the top of the page, and you can actually listen to all the last past year or so of Gramian editions, and a few that even go back further than that. We've got probably still more back there in the archives somewhere, down there in Studio C down the hall, that people will be able to access and listen to at some point in the future just as well. But there's all kinds of stuff, and you can listen to all your favorite Gramians live from the bunker in past episodes. All those made entirely available to the public and at no cost. Lots and lots to catch up on if you're a new listener. You know, Caleb, we're going to be talking about some wild stuff tonight. Have you heard about a 300 million-year-old UFO tooth wheel that was found in Russia? You know about this one? In fact, I think you do. You sent this story to me.
Indeed, I do.
There's going to be a lot of interesting stuff that we're going to be touching on tonight, in addition to a bit about the Melba Ketchum controversy with regard to Bigfoot and this Bigfoot DNA sequencing thing. You know, Lauren Coleman has apparently spoken out about this finally, and then there'll be a few other things that we'll be touching on just as well. But all that to say, it's been pretty busy. Caleb, how have you been doing?
I've been wonderful. I've really been enjoying fixing up your website for you, pal. No,
yeah,
I'm just kidding. Actually, I'm very excited about not only being here on the show, but everything we got going on in the future of the Gramian Report.
Working on some new guests as well. Just a few people I've been talking with. Peter Robbins, the you know, really, he's one of the very best UFO researchers out there that I know. Definitely want to get Nick Redfern back on. Haven't had Nick on for an update in quite a while. And then one of our research associates, you know, one of the guys who is a contributor here to the site, Tyler Pittman, has been contributing in terms of, you know, helping us find some fantastic guests and people that we can feature on the site. See that book right there? I wish we could get the author of that book. Oh, that's right. It's John Keel. It's kind of hard to get the author of a book on a program when the author is, well, no longer among the living. Anyway.
How do you pronounce that?
I believe it's Jadu.
Jadu.
Yeah, that's a Hindi word for black magic. Yeah, it's one of the ones we've had lying around the bunker here for the last few days. Anomalous Books have put that new edition of Jadu out. You know, that was John Keel's first book. And, yeah, it's a really, really interesting book all about, you know, he was, probably just in his late 20s. He wasn't much older than us, and he was working overseas as a foreign correspondent and a journalist and all this, and decided he wanted to pursue the beast to its lair, so to speak, and began, his very interesting pursuit of, magic. So it's a very interesting book. That and, of course, Encounters with Star People. I wonder if RD6 Killer Clark, the author of that one, would be willing to come on the program. You know, in the past we featured a very interesting interview along those same lines with a woman named Nancy Redstar. Folks who are fans of the popular Ancient Aliens program, you may have seen Nancy on that show a few times just as well. And speaking of guests, tonight we're going to be joined by a very spectacular guest. He is the author of a new book that's all about anomalies in the outback. That's right, it's Andrew Nicholson, author of Weird Australia. You want to find out more about his book, if you're listening live, then you're already at the Graylian Report, and all you got to do is right there next to the player that's actually streaming this to you live. If you're listening to the podcast, head on over to the website www.graylianreport.com. And you'll see in the middle column there, right under the donate button, near the top of the page, Uncanny Creatures, Strange Sightings, and Extraordinary Encounters, Weird Australia. That's the new book by Andrew Nicholson. He'll be joining us tonight on the Graylian Report to talk a little bit about that. And all that said, I tell you, I'm trying to follow some of the news this evening, and there's so much going on out there. I seem to have heard something, you know, about another potential shooting. We may touch on that a little later in the program if we get an opportunity. Some of the other things we'll be touching on tonight. Stephen Greer has now claimed that he has an alien body. Can't wait to get into a little bit of that. The Disclosure Project, they're disclosing. Caleb, I think they're probably disclosing a little prematurely, frankly. But that seems to be the case so often in this field, huh?
That old humdrum, I have an alien body.
You know, well, first it was a Bigfoot body, right? And now they're claiming that they have an alien body. I thought I was doing an Obama impersonation there for a minute. You know, first they claimed they had a Bigfoot body. And Michelle and I went, we saw the Bigfoot. It wasn't a Bigfoot.
But we couldn't see the Bigfoot because we had the inaugural ball.
We had the alien body at the inaugural ball. The alien was alive at the time we began the ball. He was eating off of the cheese wheel with the rest of us.
I think my Obama sounded more like Clinton.
Barack Obama invited me over there to the White House to check out this little alien body they had laying up there. A little humdinger laying up there. They had him stretched out right there in the Oval Office. I seen him. I said,
you see, the aliens are terrorizers.
Yeah, the aliens are.
You see? My Bush sounds more like Reagan. This is awful.
Well, the Gipper, you know, he claimed that aliens had already come down to planet Earth.
How did we get here?
Well, you know, Caleb, actually, according to Giorgio Tsoukalos, the aliens had something to do with that just as well. I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens.
I'm not saying Giorgio is behind the entire alien conspiracy, but I am.
Yeah, and you know, here we are talking about the mysteries of humankind and all this fascinating stuff, and yet the number one story out there in the news today, they're talking about, apparently, it was Beyonce that was singing at the inaugural ball yesterday, right? And this pre-recorded vocal track. Get that?
She Millie Vanilli does.
She totally. Dude, hashtag totes, we got Millie Vanilli'd. It really happened, folks. It really does. Anyway, well, a lot more is going to be happening tonight. Stay with us. When we come back here on the Graylian Report, we're going to be getting into the meat of the conversation. We're going to hope that technical difficulties will not plague us all night. I think Caleb has got his anti-Hadal spray, so we're going to keep the little mouthing teeth of the potato-faced Hadals off of our cables this evening. It is the Graylian Report back in the bunker and coming to you live. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay tuned.
50 feet, turn left. Why are you driving so slowly?
After a few drinks, I'm taking it slow.
Well, you're not fooling the cop behind you.
What?
Get ready to pay in 0.1 miles.
Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report. Still working out a few of the kinks on this new system tonight, but I think overall things are working out fairly well. I'm Micah Hanks. Always a lot to talk about. So little time to do it. We will be joined during Hour 2 by Andrew Nicholson, researcher extraordinaire and the man behind WeirdAustralia.com. I tell you, it's a great website. Andrew Nicholson sent along some information that I featured in the UFO Singularity. And it had to do with the 1800s airships. I mean, that's some really bizarre stuff. Who in the world, and I've always wondered this, who out there would have been utilizing advanced technologies around the turn of not the past century, okay, 1990s into the 2000s. I'm talking about the 1890s into the 1900s, okay? The turn of the last century, the previous century. Who would have been utilizing this incredibly advanced technology way back then? That's a fascinating thing to me, if not at times a little bit troubling. And it always, you know, in the UFO Singularity, of course, I get into, well, was there some sort of a nascent and yet nonetheless very, very, very clandestine technology that was kept out of the public view but that was being utilized back that long ago? It's a very interesting concept. And if that were the case, well, if someone were innovating back behind the scenes and they were doing this, and that technology somehow remained hidden. Could it be? I mean, I know this sounds really far out there, but let's just throw it out right now, just for you know, the sake of healthy speculation. I think that that's a healthy thing to do from time to time. Could it be that in ancient, well, not in ancient times, but you know, back prior to our First World War, when we were utilizing more advanced aviation for purposes of warfare, could somebody have been working on something behind the scenes? And if that's the case, could that somehow fit into the UFO mystery as we know it today? And that's something that's always interested me, because if there were a technology that were running along all this time behind the scenes, that seems entirely, if not incredibly absurd to a lot of people, it seems entirely impossible. But I've wondered about that in the context of the potential for there being a technological singularity. Now, fast forward to the future. Well, the present. Oh, well, I mean, the future is now, right? Great Scott, Marty, you're not thinking fourth dimensionally. But, you know, Caleb, I saw this story. This actually, now this is interesting. This was from Glenn Beck's website. Love him or hate him. Love or hate the guy. On his story this morning, the political commentator was actually talking about the singularity on his program. Can you believe that? This is what it had to do with. Google co-founder Sergey Brin was spotted recently on the New York City subway last weekend wearing some pretty strange-looking headgear. Now, rumors have run rampant in the tech world since Google's Project Glass was teased last April, but it now appears as though the technology is almost ready to go. Sergey was walking around wearing these Google glasses, not to be confused with Google goggles. These were Google glasses. Here's essentially how these puppies would work. I'm putting on my goggles. I look over, and I see Caleb, and it gives me information about Caleb so that I know not only that I'm looking at someone. Of course, I know Caleb. Most of the people who listen to this program know who he is, but I look over, and it gives me information about you. Caleb's walking down the street, and it gives him information about a chick that he wants to go over and talk to, you know? See, this is what we're talking about. I mean, now, this isn't going to be, you know, a kind of technology where you pay for, well, I'd hope it wouldn't be, but I mean, let's say you pay for a subscription service, okay, and it gives you access to being able to, you know, well, think about, like, for instance, internet white pages, Facebook, things like that. That information, people can control their privacy settings, but what if Google Glasses, for instance, would interlink with or interface with Facebook, right? If that were the case, you could be walking down the street and you could literally be getting information that people make public on their Facebook page in your Google Glasses, and you could literally have that information about a person utilizing facial recognition software. I don't know, Caleb, what do you think about that?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, with Google, you can type in anybody's name and it'll bring up their, if it's the same person that you're looking for, it'll bring up their Twitter page and obviously, like you said, things like Facebook, all the public information on Facebook. That is kind of an interesting concept to think that you would look at somebody that you don't even know and then be given all this information. It's like, well, that kind of changes the dynamic of meeting somebody, because at that point, you don't even have to walk up and ask somebody their name anymore. It's just like, oh, well, I already know about that person. And another thing that I was thinking about that's kind of crazy is you're looking around and it's like, oh, look, there's a convicted felon. It's like, yeah. Oh, this guy is a registered sex offender. I need to steer clear of this person. It makes me wonder also with the Google Glasses, how you were talking about some sort of subscription. It would most likely have to be some sort of LTE or 4G wireless network to get the stuff to work anywhere that you were anyway, so you could pick up the internet access. So I would imagine that through a phone company or something like that, you would need to have some sort of subscription, unless Google sets up their own wireless subscription.
Well, they own everything else.
Yeah,
I could see them in the next few years, you know, harnessing that kind of not just technology, but that kind of an enterprise altogether. Well, so Beck on his program apparently was talking about this, and he'd cited an article that was referred to in The Independent. These are the Google Glasses that Ray Kurzweil talked about. Of course, Kurzweil's been a guest on Beck's program, as I understand. And one of the things that concerns me, Glenn told his listeners, is there's no way to stop this technology. I'm not saying this technology is bad. I'm saying you just better be aware of the approaching singularity, the combination of man and machine, because it is coming. This is Glenn Beck that was saying this. While the technology is certainly remarkable, the intended usage, as Glenn explained, is a little sketchy. He says, if I'm wearing these Google Glasses, and he goes into some of the same stuff that we're talking about, you know, just the different kinds of things that these glasses might be capable of doing, while this may seem relatively harmless in situations where the people involved have pure intentions, the capabilities of the glasses could, of course, obviously prove dangerous. If somebody nefarious was involved, they could come up to you and say, hey, Mary, how are you? Good to see you. We went to school together. You never went to school with that person, but you're able to obtain information about that person as though you had gone to school with them.
Man, never trust a guy with technologically infused glasses.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. But, I mean, it's true. I mean, this is getting to the next page kind of stuff that that Huxley talked about, you know, in Brave New World, and that the science fictions of yesteryear all talked about. Take yesterday's inauguration events, for example. You're telling me, Beck said, that sitting in a giant crowd yesterday at the inauguration, you didn't want to have a few Secret Service agents around the president, around the first lady, walking near him and then just scanning the crowd, Glenn asked. He says, you're not going to look for cameras anymore, but people who are wearing those glasses, you know, just like you said. The future is bright. The technology is coming around the corner. Really exciting stuff, but freaky, freaky stuff as well. You know, again, I'm not telling people that they have to endorse Glenn Beck. I thought it was very interesting that Glenn was talking about the singularity on his program, and that he's acknowledging this kind of technological prowess that may already be in our midst. I mean, we're, like you said, it's right around the corner. When I was talking with Jeff Belanger on the program today, he says, you know, what about the last few years has changed all this? And with the book, The UFO Singularity, what makes you think that, you know, we're going to be any closer now to understanding this kind of technology? Or when I say this kind of technology, I mean coming closer to understanding UFOs. What about now than maybe, you know, a few decades ago? And again, my answer would, you know, Kurzweil calls this, what, the law of accelerating returns, right?
Indeed.
Yeah, he's talking about, you know, essentially there's so much technology out there. There are so many advanced sciences, so many realms of academia that are exploring new possibilities and advanced new ways of thinking and, of course, computing. You know, the digital realm is really where a lot of this is going on. And each of these different areas influences each other in such a cumulative way that the rate of growth of technology is actually greater than exponential. And so what I told Jeff Belanger is, hey, man, seriously, right now, at the rate at which our technology is growing, we're just going to be a few years, maybe a couple of decades away from leveling ourselves, leveling that proverbial playing field, at which point we will be able to probably understand things about not just UFOs, not just the unexplained mysteries of our world. This is how that all plays into the unexplained. But we're also going to understand things that we may never have even thought about to begin with. You know, there may be levels of our reality that we become aware of through technological implementations like that that really change the way we see the world. And see, a lot of people say, oh, man, but you're getting into transhumanism, and that's just shaky area. That's just bad stuff, man. Micah Hanks, are you an advocate for eugenics? Hey, I never said I was comfortable with all that stuff, and I certainly don't know that I want somebody, you know, out there tampering with my DNA. But the truth is that the technology that will allow for that kind of thing, it's around the corner.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting. I can't remember exactly how you said that Glenn had described it as basically the train is already on the track and it's heading that way no matter what. And I think that's something that we have to realize through our economy. Our economy is constantly driving the new innovations in technology, and it's always striving to be the most cutting-edge technology and how catchy this technology is with society and how easy it is to use and socially applicable.
Mm-hmm.
And that right there economically just drives this technology towards an exponential rate because we're mm-hmm. all, it's like this, it's the competition.
Go.
But that's the thing that a lot of people that I discuss singularity with have a problem with, and they're like, it's getting here too quick. We have to find a way to slow it down because they look at singularity, and a lot of people do, as a possible end to mankind, which it possibly could be. It could be a big change, but a lot of people think that it could be just, you know, hellfire and brimstone if the artificial intelligence comes and destroys us all, which is a very possible scenario.
Well,
but
yeah.
The thing that we need to take into consideration is that it's very possible now that there is no stopping this growth of technology at the rate that it's going. It's all about if we adapt to it, possibly.
That was something that Beck said on his program. He says, you know, right now this technology can't be stopped. I mean, it's already on the way. It's like a ball rolling down a hill right now, you know?
And that's why, for me, looking in a survivalist kind of outlook, it's more so, okay, if it actually is unstoppable, then what do we do to survive? What do you do to keep going?
You know, I think it was Richard Syrett's show the other night. It was Sunday night. I went on the conspiracy show, and Richard asked a question. He kind of brought up some research that there'd been a man who was trying to create a computerized brain. This gentleman, what was the researcher's name? I can't recall. But the question he asked was based on this guy's research. He felt that we may get to a point where people who essentially augment their intelligence through brain-computer interfaces, they basically get to a point where there are some who have this augmentation and there are others who don't, and essentially some sort of an economic disparity arises between the two of them, and therefore a conflict emerges. There could even be a war, and it could be, humans versus, you know, what would you call them, Homo mechanicus? You know, now, but the thing is I say, again, so often what I see in this sort of stuff is that there is this kind of a speculative, and there's nothing wrong with speculation, but what I distinctly am seeing here is this consistent, kind of a Hollywood interpretation of it. You know, everyone keeps thinking, Rise of the Machines, you know?
Sam
Wickwicky. I mean, and that's the whole thing is that, you know, Hollywood has definitely flavored the way that we expect the future to be, and it's not just with singularity. Again, you know, we're not trying to become, you know, it's no longer the Graylian Report, folks, it's the Singularity Watch. No, I mean, Caleb, check out, for only $9.95 you can get your Singularity Watch. No.
Wow.
No, but I mean, what I'm trying to say is that is interesting, and this is something that definitely, with the book The UFO Singularity, I drive that point home. This has everything to do with the kind of advanced technologies we see already with ufology. And even when I was interviewing some of the people for the book, they were saying, you know, Mike, I don't see a parallel between UFOs and technological singularity like you're saying here. And I would explain every time, you know, I actually would differ with you. Clearly, if we're dealing with a technology that appears to be greater than what we know to exist in on Earth already today, well, then if singularity talks about essentially the attainment of the very same sort of thing, couldn't we stand to learn by comparing aspects of these two phenomena together? And the same thing goes on with extraterrestrial studies, okay? Again, coming back to the idea of taking Hollywood and just using that, I mean, taking it truly at face value. Hollywood is everything, and everything that we think we know is based on science fiction. I was on Eldon Taylor's program, Provocative Enlightenment, earlier today, and he had said, so essentially what you're saying, Micah, is that, you know, or how did he phrase it? I think he'd said, all your projections of the future could be likened to a science fiction interpretation of the future. And I said, well, yes, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I said, you got to keep in mind some of our greatest minds, you know, mathematician Arthur C. Clarke. He predicted the creation of the radio telecommunications satellite, and he, of course, wrote famous sci-fi, you know, classics, the likes of 2001 A Space Odyssey. Now, in 2001, we were already, you know, piloting manned missions to Jupiter and beyond the infinite. We didn't quite hit that mark, did we? Or did we? Who knows? If there's a secret space program, maybe we did. But again, I think that, you know, we color all aspects of our culture. Technology, extraterrestrial life, science, religion, all these things, romance, dating, everything gets colored by the way that we see it in films. Sometimes I wonder if we're not literally, basically, a bunch of puppets walking around trying to act out the roles of characters that we see in movies.
Well, you have to think about it, too. I mean, and I think we've even talked about this before, not on the show because I haven't really been around that much, but talking about the parallels between taking a movie like iRobot or something like that, where Will Smith is battling these artificial intelligence. And sorry, guys, spoiler alert. That basically gets turned on by what's his name that becomes self-aware on the moon. What's that book?
Oh, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Yeah,
Robert
yeah.
Heinlein. Yeah.
And what was the name of the main
Mike, I think, was the computer.
Like,
yeah.
Well, basically, Mike turns on all the artificial intelligences, and then they have to kill Will Smith. Now, if you think about this too, and how you were talking about how we're subconsciously influenced by pretty much everything that we perceive. Now, if you look at any movie that is, you know, a chick flick, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, or something like that, you look time after time after time of these ridiculous fairy tale romances that happen on screen, and we look at that and we think, why doesn't that ever happen to me? Why don't I model my love life after this? And then we expect like ridiculous expectations of going out and meeting this special someone that is the identical proverbial girl that you're supposed to meet that's just like you and she's perfect in every way. But that is such a completely unrealistic ideal to have. But we are always subconsciously, I do it, I know I do, subconsciously looking for this perfect movie mate, so to speak. So
yeah,
that's something that you need to look at when we're trying to put the parallels of this is exactly what's going to happen when the robots become self-aware. They're going to kill us. Or this is exactly what's going to happen when I meet this girl. You know, we don't know those situations. And that's why I really, really love how artificial intelligence specialist Ben Goertzel will look at everything in a very, like, here it is on one hand, here it is on the other. Yes, we could possibly be killed by these artificial intelligences, or it could be some sort
He's one of the only guys that does that, too.
Yeah, he really is one of the only people that I've heard that does that. And then, you know, you can look on the other hand of this, you know, best case scenario, this kind of cyber utopian world where we live hand in hand with the AIs, which he says, that would be great. I hope that happens, but if it doesn't, it's not going to be that surprising because we don't know. And that's something that I'm trying actively to make my mind do more.
What is the act of unlearning, unknowing what?
No, basically just saying, look, I just don't know. It's fun to speculate. It's fun to think about these ways. It's fun to think maybe I'm going to meet the perfect woman or maybe I'm going to meet the perfect AI one day. Right. But it's better just to say, look, I don't know. So let's just keep going and try to figure out as best we can.
Let's just hang right there in that radical center that we call the middle, right? The middle ground.
Indeed.
Well, you know, again, I would like to bring this back around to extraterrestrial stuff, okay?
Because you would.
Why would I? No. Why would? No. Anyway, that ever reputable news source that we all know before it's news. See, I told you the future was now.
The internet?
The internet. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, where do you get your news? The internet. Yes. Well, no, I hope folks do get their news at the Graylian Report. And, you know, if you're listening to this tonight, you are already at the Graylian Report. And so all I got to tell you, you know, you're not going to hurt the player unless you actually click on another article. But you can scroll right down the page there. And you'll see some of the recent articles that we've got up there at the website. One, what's going on at Fort Campbell, Kentucky? This is interesting. It's getting a little into the area of the conspiracies and stuff. I'll just put it to you like this. What do black helicopters, UFOs, and Jimi Hendrix all have in common? Well, you want to check out this article. It's a good one. It's what a producer, a television producer friend of mine, recently emailed me and referred to as the Area 51 of Appalachia. So check it out and see if you agree. And then speaking of Area 51, there was this really interesting email I'd got. I actually mentioned this on the last edition of the podcast. It is an email that came from none other than the National Atomic Testing Museum. Got it right over here. And they've got a new Area 51 exhibit over there. Caleb and I are actually, we plan at present to go and check out the Area 51 Museum. And this, get this, okay, the National Atomic Testing Museum. I don't know how I got on their email list, but I was apparently added by someone. Okay, let's hope it wasn't another one of those men in black.
It was John Connor.
It was John Connor. He added me in the future. But anyway, I was added to this list, and I put this article up on the Grayling Report. You can find it right there, about third piece down, Area 51, Reverse Engineering and the Smithsonian. That's right. The National Atomic Testing Museum in Las Vegas, Nevada is actually an association, or it is rather a museum in association with the Smithsonian Institute. How about them apples? And now here's the thing. I'm not sure if it's just going to be there for a while or if this is going to be a standing exhibit, but they've got an exhibit there at the National Atomic Testing Museum dedicated to Area 51 where they talk about reverse engineering. And so I was interested in this, put this article up, and of course our good friend Jason McClellan from Open Minds contacts me and says, hey man, I was there, check this out, and he sends a video, and Open Minds had already beat us to the punch. Granted, they're 5 hours away from Las Vegas, so Jason just flew over there, went and checked out the museum, and put together a nice video vignette about it. So we've got that linked in that article just as well. I thought it was very interesting, though, that a museum in Las Vegas, Nevada, okay, in association with the Smithsonian, has got a damned museum. Or rather, has got an exhibit that is dedicated to Area 51. It's bizarre.
Interesting.
It is interesting. So anyway, we've got that up at the Grayling Report. You can check that out just as well as a bit of commentary about the inauguration. Here's all I'll say about the inauguration. And here I thought I was onto something. And of course, I turn on the radio this afternoon, and Pete Callender, our afternoon host here in Asheville, North Carolina, was talking about the exact same thing. He says, hey, guess what? Did we really need to spend that much money on an inauguration for a standing president? And I have to agree. You know, again, this isn't anything against Obama. I posted something about this online, and a friend of mine put a link up that said, as soon as you start referring to yourself as a taxpayer, you're about to be a, and then expletive. So that's not what I'm trying to do, and I'm certainly not picking on our present commander-in-chief. All I am saying
is, did they really need lobster, scallion, Blanc in the doggy bags?
Yes, exactly. Did we really need to spend quite so much? And the thing is that the official word on the expenditures has not completely come back. All I do know is that I looked into this enough to at least know this much. There was a congressional luncheon, okay, that portions of the actual inaugural ceremony and then the congressional luncheon cared for by a specific fund that comes from taxpayer dollars. So, you know, if you don't like the idea...
Well, Mike, aren't you happy that we put the bill for that whole thing?
You know, I tell you, here I'm talking about us having to launch an Indiegogo, to try and get help. And of course, I can stop and take time to buy lunch for my congressman in the middle of all of it.
You're a great guy, Micah.
I went hungry, but I bought my congressman lunch, you know? So anyway, well, not to rant off on that. I know a lot of the folks don't like it when we talk about politics, but how do you feel about that? Do you like having to pay for somebody else's lunch for a lavish inauguration that's going on in Washington, you know? And again, it could have been a little simpler, right? They did a very quiet Sunday ceremony swearing in on Sunday, but then they had to do it again on Monday. And now Obama's actually been sworn in 4 times. What do you think about that? Talk about it more on the other side of this break here on the Grayling Report.
Monsters could be living under your child's bed or in the bathtub. For a child with asthma, it can seem like monsters are everywhere because something as innocent as a teddy bear could trigger their next asthma attack. But there are simple ways you can help, like putting stuffed animals in the freezer to kill dust mites and drying bath toys to prevent mold. Learn more at noattacks.org or call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. That's 1-866-NO-ATTACKS because their next breath is in your hands. Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Back to the Grayling Report, final segment of this hour, kind of wrapping things up a little bit. You know, enough about the inauguration. Let's talk about something else that goes on over there in Washington, and specifically what I'm talking about over there in the Washington area is the Disclosure Project. You know, I try not to harp on HARP. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm just another guy like you trying to figure it all out, right? But the thing is, and here's where I'm going with this, okay? Someone asked me, actually it was Eldon Taylor on his program today about Dr. Stephen Greer, and you know, Greer's done a lot. If you buy the whole Disclosure thing, Greer's done a lot for the movement, if you will. The movement. He certainly has done a lot for the movement. Caleb, were you with me when Greer gave a lecture here in Asheville? Were you at that presentation?
I don't believe I was there.
Okay, well, we went out and we actually heard Dr. Stephen Greer give a lecture here in Asheville. But Greer is the kind of guy, I have to pick on him just a little bit. He's one of these people who not only is advocating disclosure, he's a medical doctor. He's got all kinds of uber credibility, you know, because he is a person who has attained, you know, letters behind his name. He's become a political activist. He claims to have briefed the CIA, you know, I think most of the standing presidents, at least since Bill Clinton or so. And yet Greer also will tell you that he'll sit out there with his group of people gathered around singing Kumbaya out in the middle of the National Forest, talking with E.T., using telepathy.
You don't do that, Micah?
Am I supposed to be doing that?
I don't know. I thought that's how we got into the inauguration ceremony.
Maybe I missed something. I don't know. But the Disclosure Project, you know, it's been a good thing. Whether or not, I'm personally not so sure. I think that the government's hiding all this, all that much information. That's really what I think, okay? I think that there's probably a lot that's being held, but not as much as people probably think. And yet, in other words, I don't know that the government really knows all that much, at least as much as they claim that they would. But the thing is that I was asked about Stephen Greer, and I just had to say, I told Eldon Taylor on Provocative Enlightenment today, that in my opinion, I get the impression that, if anything, Stephen Greer is a person who, I'll just put this out there, I think he lets his ego get a little bit in the way of really being an effective mouthpiece for a movement. And I think, frankly, that he gets a little bit more woo than I and a lot of the people in the ufological community are truly comfortable with. He's got this kind of cult of personality going on. He shows up at the events. He struts around. He's got his bodyguards. You know, Jason and Maureen were talking to me about an incident that occurred at the International UFO Congress where Caleb and I will be this coming February. And Greer had shown up, and he had a bodyguard who brought a gun along. Boy, that's not a hot issue right now, huh? Oh, speaking of, Caleb, didn't you tell me just before we went on the air, you know, I've had four interviews today. No, three interviews and then this show. Was there not another shooting attempt today?
Yeah, apparently it was at a college campus in Houston, Texas, although I've been quite busy dealing with some of this IT stuff, so I wasn't really able to get a whole grasp on it all.
Boy, that's comforting. That's actually not at all. You know, again, I am always interested in some of the synchromistic parallels that show up in these sorts of things, the copycat crimes and all this sort of stuff. No one better probably to talk about that than cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman, who I'm going to come back around to here in just a moment. But finishing up where I'm going with this disclosure thing, the ever-reputable Before It's News website, they actually carry some good stuff, but they did carry this bit about Stephen Greer, where Greer of the famous Disclosure Project claims to have a tiny alien body. Now, okay, he's been out there singing Kumbaya, talking to extraterrestrials or plankton on the East Coast, you know, who knows what exactly. He's been out there riding the Disclosure donkey, and now he's claiming that he has a tiny alien body.
Which he found by following a trail of Reese's Pieces.
Yes, yes, yes. Shiny little breadcrumbs illuminated in the moonlight.
That's not an alien. That's a dehydrated Hansel.
After many weeks of travel, we are back to report that amazing results have been obtained from our study of the small possible ET body. Stephen Greer is an American osteopath and ufologist who founded the Orion Project and the Disclosure Project. Dr. Bravo, Emery Smith, and I traveled to the country that is now home to this small possible ET body, and we were able to successfully obtain extensive X-ray and CT scans of the entire body. We were also able to obtain DNA samples under sterile surgical conditions. Great! So we've been going through this whole DNA mess with Bigfoot, and now we're going to have an alien DNA!
Be careful, man. You know what happens when you get angry. People don't like you when you get angry. You turn into Alex Jones.
That's right. It's worse than the Hulk. I turn into Alex Jones. They're going to take our guns!
An entire fleet of Pierce Morgans will fly out of the sky, and you'll have to save us.
Oh, man, I was on the Conspiranormal podcast last night, and those guys just know. They're based out of Nashville and everything, and I told them if we ever make it over to Nashville, we're going to have to catch up with those dudes. They've got the best name for a podcast ever, too, Conspiranormal, but they know about the Alex Jones thing. Seriously, I was injected with Alex Jones serum years ago.
Oh, and, that sucks.
Yeah, and now if you make me mad, don't make me mad. I'll turn into the Bullock. I turn into Alex Jones. It's like, no, get out of the room.
Jones smash. All right. Well, just so I don't have to sit in the studio with him, can you not turn into Alex?
Keep it. Learning to control my anger. Learning to control my Alex.
It's through Pilates. Just, you're good.
Well, anyway, yeah, so now we're going to be dealing apparently with a little alien DNA guy now. The X-ray and the CT scan show an intact, actual, biological human organoid.
Organoid.
It's an organoid, yeah.
Gosh, is that a Hadel term?
It's a humanoid, yes, yes, yes. Actually, organoids are an entire subset of the Hadels, but I digress. An actual biological humanoid organism without question. Astonishing 3D images, according to Greer, were able to be constructed of the body from the detailed CT scan. We were able to see internal organs such as lungs and what I am fairly sure, he says, is a heart structure. But why are we calling this thing alien? Very interesting. The images have just been examined by the world's foremost authority on skeletal abnormalities, dysplasias, and fetal skeletal syndromes. And he stated that this thing is, well, unlike any known skeletal structure found in humans. We also know that it is not an ancient hominid, and while humanoid, it is not apparently human. You know who I met a few months ago, Caleb, was Lloyd Pye, the guy with the Star Child skull. And Lloyd and I were riding together on a bus with Grant Cameron, actually, the presidential UFOs guy. Psychic Chip Coffey was on there with us, and Tom Fusco, our good friend, who I think may have called me today, and I probably didn't check my voicemails, but I digress. And I was sitting there talking with Lloyd about the Star Child skull, and they've really spent years and years and years and years trying to substantiate scientifically what that thing may or may not be. And I have to say, they brought an entire reproduction of, with a visible cross-section of the Star Child skull, Lloyd and his assistant. I don't know what that thing is, but man, they have spent years trying to understand it. I would be very careful during or following a cursory examination of a small body, as Greer is talking about here. I would be very careful about, you know, coming forth and saying this thing doesn't appear to be human, only after even a very in-depth cursory or, you know, initial examination, because again, with the Star Child skull, we still don't know exactly what that thing is. Lloyd tells me he thinks it's not human, but they've studied that thing for, God, how long now? Maybe a couple of decades.
Yeah, probably.
I should actually get Lloyd on the program, because that's another one of those little bits of evidence out there. You know, I'm not, everybody who listens to this program knows I'm not really an advocate, per se, of the extraterrestrial hypothesis. I don't rule it out. I don't rule anything out. But, man, that instance, that thing, that Starchild skull is really interesting.
Well, think about this, though, too. Let's just imagine for a second that the Elephant Man, we had not been present when he was around. Let's just say that we find the Elephant Man's skeleton somewhere in a field, and he just was what he was and somehow survived, you know, on his own, maybe as some sort of pre-what we know as human kind of caveman scenario. And we find that, and we're like, holy crap. Mm-hmm. This has got to be an alien. But, you know, there's all kinds of strange anomalies that happen with bodies. I mean, look at the Harlequin syndrome.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That doesn't affect the skeleton as far as I know.
Well, it could potentially contribute to more cartilage and less bone, okay?
Yeah,
because
that's true.
You know, because an infant skeleton, you know, it's not fully formed, and as a child is born, there's more cartilage than bone, and then of course, you know, bone is replaced in various parts of the body as that child ages. The thing about the Starchild skull is that unlike testing of for instance John Merrick, the Elephant Man, there should be, if a body is discovered that appears to be humanoid but non-human, testing should be able to determine conclusively, based on genetic codes and things like this, that this is a human. I mean, a human is determinable. A human is determinable based on the genetic substructure, you know, and all the things that in the genetic makeup identify a human as being a human. Whereas with the Starchild, according to Lloyd Pye, this thing is, again, what Greer is claiming now about this little alien mummy guy. He got a little alien mummy down there.
Hot diggity dang.
But he's saying that this thing is not human. Lloyd's taken years to come to that conclusion with the Starchild thing, and I'm sure that there are people who would say not quite, and you know, the naysayers. Again, I'm not saying that I believe the Starchild skull is anything. It is an anomaly. It's like the Shroud of Turin. It's something that is weird. We don't know what it is. But we know what it isn't, and according to Lloyd Pye, that thing is not human. Which reminds me again of that ever-present, that lingering cloud of noxious flatulence that has been referred to in the Bigfoot community recently as this Melba Ketchum DNA study.
Yeah.
Have you been following this thing?
Yeah, a little bit. I actually caught the interview of one of the lead female scientists that was on the group, and she was talking about how she was kind of disappointed that she was involved with the scenario and basically just got kind of drawn in, and she was saying, yeah, I didn't think Bigfoot was out there, I didn't really care if Bigfoot was out there, and now I am the center of attention, and people are asking me all about this, and she basically still was like, yeah, I don't know, I don't really care.
Well, according to the Bigfoot Lunch Club website, did you know that there was a website called the Bigfoot Lunch Club?
I'd like to know what they do.
They actually have an outstanding blog on Bigfoot, and there was an article posted today. No, I'm sorry, this was on Sunday. Again, here I am, 2 days late and a dollar short. Cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman. There's somebody that we do respect quite a bit here on the Graylian Report, and Coleman speaks out about Melba Ketchum's Bigfoot DNA study. He had said, quote, my standard is no data, no discovery, and why is she saying ridiculous things like these are angels from heaven? Is she claiming that Bigfoot are the Nephilim now or something like that?
Why not?
There have been many who have tried to assert that there is some sort of a, what would you call it here, you know, a metaphysical component to the Bigfoot enigma. I couldn't begin to tell you if that is or is not the case. But, you know, if we're talking about hard science, we should try to be a little bit more skeptical. That's something I always say, don't I? We should all try to be a bit more skeptical. And that's why I liked what Lauren Coleman had to say about this Bigfoot DNA study. Lauren has followed this. He hasn't really come right out and up until now really just laid his cards out on the table with regard to this. I think that like all good researchers, he's waited to try and see if information came forth. But this is apparently what he said. In an article by Randall Beach for the New Haven Register, Coleman was asked about his approach to cryptozoology. And this is what he said. And I like this, and he does bring up Melba Ketchum's study. This resonates with my heart because it's so much like what we try and do here at the Graylian Report. Coleman said, actually, I'm just going to quote the actual New Haven Register article. He stated, I am a skeptic. Coleman, therefore, demands to see plenty of hard evidence before believing any of the many claims of creature sightings. He said, quote, I try to interview a witness first. I try to understand the human element. The creature is important to me, but I'm never blown away by a piece of evidence. I always look for the motive. For instance, he investigated the claim by a veterinarian in Texas who claims she discovered a being that was part human, part primitive. My standard is, again, here's that quote, no data, no discovery, Coleman said. And why is she saying ridiculous things like these are angels from heaven? Coleman said that for every 100 cases of new animal claims, about 80 of them are mistaken identity. One is a hoax, and the other 19 are unknown. But the media always goes crazy about those hoaxes, Coleman noted. And that Bigfoot hoaxers, he said, are, quote, really evil people. You know, on that note, I think I brought it up on the program already once before. Isn't Matt Whitten? No, it was Rick Dyer, one of the two guys who was involved in that Bigfoot hoax that was going on down in Georgia a few years ago. I think that the guy is back at it trying to do this all over again. And there's one of these videos. I think I saw it linked to one of the popular Bigfoot sites the other day. Is this the actual face of a Sasquatch? When in reality, I don't think it is. I think it's another one of these little digital renderings that Dyer is behind. A guy who, when he helped initiate that first hoax, okay, with the Bigfoot in the cooler, had said, we hoaxed everybody and we could probably do it all again. Let's hope he doesn't. We'll be talking more about cryptozoology in the Outback when we come back here on the Grayling Report.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Program Micah Hanks here, the veritable mouth of the South, and you've locked in. It is the Grayling Report, your home for right and reason in an unreasonable world. Joined in studio tonight by Caleb Hanks. We're glad to have you here, Caleb, helping out. I'll tell you, we needed a helping hand tonight because there was so much going on with our new interface, and we've soldiered through it. You know, sometimes you just got to get in there and get your feet muddy. And that's what we've been doing tonight. So despite all the technical difficulties, we've been rife with technical difficulties, but we're going to be back on track with things and better than ever before. This is what I've been talking about. We've been really hoping to be able to bring something that's a cut above what a lot of the other podcasts and blogs and websites are doing out there. And this is only, folks, let me tell you, this is the very beginning. It's only going to get better and better and better. And it really helps to have a good staff of people on board helping you out. I was meeting with one of our field correspondents and contributors, Tyler Pittman, today about stuff, and he's kind of heading up the research department right now, and he's been reading and he's been researching and finding guests and all kinds of stuff. I mean, there's so much good stuff to come. So, truly, speaking of good stuff to come, Caleb and I, we have a special guest that will be joining us during the next segment of this hour, and that's Andrew Nicholson of WeirdAustralia.com. Go ahead and check out his website. He's got a book out of the same name, Weird Australia, that deals with, well, weird stuff that goes on down in Australia. It's exactly like the name seems to entail. And speaking of what's going on out there on the web, not necessarily in the Outback, but on the web, I'm looking, you know, since we're streaming directly to the website today, people are able to listen to the live program right there at graylianreport.com as opposed to having to use a third-party site. We really like that. We're going to do that more in the future so that you can open, you know, a parent window, or what it, my web terminology really is not right there. The parent window would be the site. Then we would open a what? Another window.
A new one.
A new one. We'll call it a new one. Yeah, open a new window that continues the player. You know, basically a pop-out player that people can listen to, and then they can scroll around and check out stuff that we refer to on the website as you're listening. That'll be the idea. We'll want to be able to do that kind of a thing. And folks are using the comments section there on the post to chat about. It works probably just about as well as an actual chat feature there. We're probably going to embed a chat feature just as well, but... And I'm seeing people talking here. Milton Finch, he's one of our regular listeners, and he's saying that tonight the Air Force dropped 4 or 5 orange-colored flares, contrasted to white flares that we've always seen them drop. He says, my entire family, 4 of us, saw an orange sphere. It was nothing like the orange flares that they were dropping tonight. Much too flary and much too bright to be the sphere we all saw. You know, I tell you, I keep hearing more and more people talking about these strange objects that are being seen. Some sort of a strange aerial light phenomenon has been repeatedly talked about down there around Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. We keep hearing about this. I don't know what it is about Myrtle Beach. And then a friend of ours, actually another correspondent of ours down in the Florida area, Christopher Blake Germain, he had called me a while back and talked about seeing something very similar to this, although he described it as being more like a pinkish kind of orb about the size of a beach ball, and this thing had been floating directly above the tree level. Ball lightning? Earth lights? Probes from outer space? I mean, who knows what these things are? Really, really strange stuff. Also noticed that Milton had said that he is eating right now a La La Land organic chocolate. That's one of our fantastic sponsors. That's Melody Dawn Germain, actually, Chris's wife. That's right. And they are proud sponsors of the Graylian Report. If you'd like to find out about how you can advertise with the Graylian Report, you can shoot us an email, info@graylianreport.com, or go right there to the website, Graylian Report, and right next to the About Us link at the top left-hand portion of the page, you'll see a little button that says Advertise. Click Advertise, and you can learn all about that. And there are all kinds of new things. If you haven't been over to the new website, check that out in general. Since you're listening to us, you're on the website right now. Check it out. We've got new features, new mail buttons, RSS. We really kind of streamlined everything and made it a little bit better, a little more easy to read. It just all around looks and feels so much better, doesn't it? Makes us all very happy. Caleb's a happy boy over here.
I sure am.
He's a happy guy. So anyway, before we get into our discussion about Weird Australia with Andrew Nicholson, who joins us from the Outback tonight. You know, this is one that I think, Caleb, you had actually sent this one along to me. About a 300... Watch me drop my paper here. 300-million-year-old UFO tooth wheel found in Russian city of Vladivostok. Boy, I'm not even going to try it. We're just going to call it the city of Vlad, okay?
Hey, that works. Don't feel so bad. You've done a lot of interviews today.
I've done a lot of interviews. I was really articulate in the first two. I hung in there as good as I could with Jeff. Of course, that one was... Two of the video interviews I did today, two of them were actually television shows. One was a video series, Spacing Out, because I was on there with our good friend Jason McClellan, in Maureen Ellsbury's rather secretive absence. And then... I went on Eldon Taylor's Provocative Enlightenment. That was a good interview. Eldon was a good interviewer, and that one was really, really good. That was by phone. And then a television program with Jeff Belanger tonight, 30-odd minutes. That one should probably be posted online tomorrow, so definitely check that one out. Jeff is one of the funniest people you'll ever meet, and he's really a good guy, too, so check that out. And then, of course, there's this. But did you not send me this...
Yeah, I did.
Okay, yeah, the 300-million-year-old UFO tooth wheel found in Russian city of what we're going to call Vlad. I think it's actually pronounced Vladivostok, but we're just going to refer to it as Vlad for safety's sake, okay? We don't want our listeners to try and repeat what they hear me saying and then they hurt their tongue.
Yeah.
Nothing worse than a sprained tongue, and then they'll try and sue us, you know, because they tried to be like Micah because they thought Micah was being cool.
Be like Mike.
Hey, don't do it, guys. There are health risks at stake here, okay? Lighting the flare... I can't. Right off the bat.
Don't even worry. Just keep going,
Caleb. Caleb, where's the little Hadel midget that comes in here and massages my shoulders when I'm doing the show?
Well, that used to be me, but now that I'm upgraded to actually being on a microphone, I shed my Hadel skin and stop giving free massages.
You've been upgraded. Wait, you were a Hadel? You're now upgraded to being a human, Caleb. Congratulations.
I wasn't actually a Hadel. I was just abducted by them, and I was learned in their ways.
You were led to believe you were a Hadel, kind of like the boy who was raised by wolves. You were like the Mowgli of the Hadels, right?
Yeah, they have some different necessities than the bears, I will say that.
Matt Oakley was the one that was raised by bears.
Yeah,
clearly Matt Oakley was raised by bears. Well, anyway, lighting the fire during a cold winter evening, a resident of Vlad found a rail-shaped metal detail, which was pressed in one of the pieces of coal that men used to heat his home. The man used to heat his home. Again, I think my left eye is twitching so bad from staring at a screen all day, I can't hardly read anymore. Mesmerized by his discovery, the responsible citizen decided to seek help from the scientists in the Primjore region. And after the metal object was studied by the leading experts, this man was shocked to learn about the assumed age of what he had found. Get this. The metal detail was supposedly 300 million years old, and yet the scientists suggested that it was not created by nature, but was rather manufactured by someone. Someone 300 million years ago? This is what we call an out-of-place object, folks. The question of who might have made an aluminum gear at the dawn of time, of course, remains unanswered. I keep hearing about these things. There was an article in Fate magazine years and years ago, and it was titled Prehistoric Nanotechnology Embedded in Rock in Russia, something like that. So this isn't the first time something like this has come about.
And why Russia?
What about modern-day Russia? You know, that was the site of the, it was near enough to the 1908 Tunguska blast. You know, some really strange stuff has happened there even in recent times, but what could have been going on 300 million years ago? Well, finding a strange artifact in coal is a relatively frequent occurrence. The first discovery of this sort was made in 1851 when workers in one of the Massachusetts mines extracted a zinc-silver-encrusted vase from a block of unmined coal. I remember reading about this one. And it dated all the way back to the Cambrian era. That's approximately 500 million years ago, folks. And then 61 years later, American scientists from Oklahoma discovered an iron pot which was pressed into a piece of coal that was 312 million years. Can you just cue, like, the intense music and, like, the echo? 312 million years, old. That's really old.
It's really old.
Yeah, that's really, really old. You're about to get really old. Really
I don't know why
old.
Arnold keeps coming up. I think this is the first time in a long time there's been a new Arnold movie coming out. But anyway.
Arnold always comes up because Arnold's hilarious. Well, when geologists broke the piece of coal in which the metal object was pressed into and spot-treated it with chemical agents, it turned out that the metal detail was unusually light and soft. No more than 7 centimeters long, the object was found to be composed of 98% aluminum and 2% magnesium. Now, on the one hand, such an alloy stalled the scientists because nearly pure aluminum is very, very rarely found in nature, and thus the detail was most definitively created artificially. On the other hand, however, when it became clear that the object had been made from aluminum-magnesium alloy, the experts quickly found an answer to the question of how a metal detail could withstand the ravages of time so well. The scientists explained that pure aluminum is increasingly prone to oxidization, which contributes to the creation of a special layer protecting it from further corrosion. And as a result, the metal detail made a 98%, or rather a detail such as this made 98% from aluminum, can endure not only high pressure but also heat and other severe natural conditions. So Russian scientists are asking whether this aluminum alloy is even of earthly origin. They say it's known from the study of meteorites that there exists extraterrestrial aluminum 26, as it's known, which subsequently breaks down into magnesium 26. The presence of 2% of magnesium in this alloy might well point to the alien origin of the aluminum detail. Nonetheless, further testing is needed to confirm this hypothesis. There are a few listeners of this program out there right now who I know, their ears have probably perked up, and I'm expecting a couple of emails. You know who you are. This is going to be a really, really, really interesting one. I'm going to be following this one. I'm going to watch it like a hawk because I'm so fascinated with those reports of out-of-place objects. Caleb, what do you think about that? Do you think it's possible that somebody was utilizing something like that that long ago?
Well, there's always this idea floating around that life on Earth basically has formed and then destroyed itself and formed and destroyed itself multiple times over, and it's this cyclical cycle that life keeps sprouting up and blowing itself up. So, you know, honestly, 300 million years, if that's the life cycle it takes for us to evolve back, and it reminds me of that guy in Men in Black who keeps getting his head blown off and growing back. You know, if that's the case, then why not?
What if that's what we're doing? You know, I can't help but glance over. You know, we keep a lot of books and a lot of media. There's your buddy Kim.com right over there, by the way.
But loves me now.
But look in this. Yeah. If you haven't seen Caleb's article about Kim.com at GraylianReport.com, check that out. But I have to reference the book over here, Mysteries of Time and Space by Brad Steiger, where he gets into a lot of those ancient, out-of-place objects. And he actually asked me to contribute a little bit to the new forward for the reissue of that book. This stuff has always fascinated me, and it will continue, and I know that it will continue to fascinate you probably as much as our guest in the next segment will be doing, Mr. Andrew Nicholson of Weird Australia. When we talk with him, we'll be digging into the greater mysteries down under here on the Graylian Report. Stay tuned. Back to the program. It's Micah Hanks, and you've locked into the Graylian Report. Boy, so good to be back on the live airwaves after traveling around and being very, very busy lately. And of course, you know, I think during the three interviews I did today, I booked five more. All in support of that little habit known as the UFO singularity. This is what it's like when you're doing a new book, you know. When you got a new book out, you have to get out there and your life just turns into madness for a couple of weeks. But I'll tell you this, I'm not the only guy with a new book out, and that's why we are supporting the habit of another fellow researcher tonight. That's none other than Andrew Nicholson of Weird Australia. Australia is someplace I've always wanted to go and visit. In fact, you know, being a writer for the last few years for Mysterious Universe, I've gotten to know Ben and Aaron very well, but there are others. Andrew Nicholson is one of those researchers, and of course, you know, people who follow the Graylian Report already know about Andrew from his book, Weird Australia, that deals with uncanny creatures, strange sightings, and extraordinary encounters out there in the outback. And of course, tonight on the program, as many probably already know, Andrew's going to be our guest. So, Andrew Nicholson, welcome for the first time to the Graylian Report.
Thanks a lot, Micah. It's great to be on your show.
Well, so glad to have you here, man. I mentioned some of the research that you've done into Australian UFO sightings dating back to the last turn of the century in my book, The UFO Singularity. And, of course, it's great to see researchers who are up and coming and then getting their own books out. Let's hope that this is only one of many more to come. So to kick this off, we mentioned the airships, and that's something about your research that I find particularly interesting. Not that we'll go entirely in a chronological fashion here, but let's take it all the way back to those early airship encounters in Australia. Tell us a bit about those.
The airship sightings began in the winter of 1909. They originally started in New Zealand, and then a couple of weeks later they seemed to have crossed Tasman and started having sightings up and down the east coast of Australia and even crossing Western Australia. Often at the time they were described as airships, but a lot of the characteristics of the flight seemed to be something more than that. There was a lot of lights, but they often moved in erratic fashion, going up and down, revolving around, and just behaving in a way that would have been impossible for any of the airships that would have been around in 1909.
Right. That's what's so fascinating about these airship reports. I mean, we appear to be dealing with something that is not our own, at least in terms of known existent technologies. And although it was known that there were a variety of different kinds of dirigibles or things that were, you know, similar to a dirigible or a blimp, not the kind that would be capable of traveling even maybe several hundreds of miles an hour, let alone the incredible speed reported with some of these airships. So it's very fascinating. What do you think that these things could have been? I mean, were they some sort of a clandestine technology, or were they from someplace else? Do you have a theory about that?
I'm not really sure. Going back even further, there's been quite a lot of UFO sightings, and even way before that there were any airships or any flight. But I'm not sure about the airships. There was a lot of talk at the time that there was a lot of inventors actually building their own airships. So whether that had something to do with it, I'm not 100% sure. Whether it was people maybe reading more into it, or whether they were genuinely craft from somewhere else, it's kind of hard to tell. But the actual reports do lend some credence to the fact that they were something that definitely wasn't available at the time.
It seems that that's the case. You know, it doesn't seem like these things, if we're to trust our guts, our journalistic, our intuition, if you will, it doesn't seem that these were something that were our own, which is what's led some researchers like Mac Maloney to put forth ideas like maybe they were time travelers. And, of course, there's always that extraterrestrial component that comes into play. And when we're getting into the discussion of alien beings, you don't even have to go out into space. You can look right here on Earth. I understand that early in your life, much like my own introduction to the Fortean and the unusual, you early in life were told stories, specifically about a hairy man. The Blue Mountain District of New South Wales, I think, is where these stories were told, and it was something that was used to kind of scare children. But maybe there's a little bit more to the story about these hairy men of that area. Tell us a little bit about that.
The Yowie, or the hairy man, is very close to my heart. Because I actually live in the Blue Mountains myself, and I've actually had a couple of kind of experiences. Not that I've actually seen anything, but I've had some weird experiences there. But the reports of the hairy man go back into the Aboriginal traditions. And then when the colonial settlers first started moving into the Blue Mountains around the 1820s, there were a lot of reports coming out then of people coming, having encounters with these large 6, 7, 8 foot tall hairy men. And it became pretty much an accepted creature for many people, or many of those early settlers that were actually living in the Blue Mountains. And it was basically right up until probably the early 1920s, and this isn't just in the Blue Mountains, but probably across New South Wales and into Queensland and Victoria, there were quite a lot of reports of these hairy creatures. And when I started investigating and doing my research, I was actually surprised at the amount of encounters that were recorded in newspapers right across the country. So, yeah, it's something that goes back a long way, and definitely even way back further into the Aboriginal traditions as well.
You know, which is so similar to the interpretation of Bigfoot or Sasquatch here in the United States just as well. You know, just one early encounter, or maybe at least a recollection that you include on the website, was attributed to Australian poet Henry Lawson in a piece he called The Hairy Man from 1903, and it said, as far back as I can remember, the yarn of the hairy man was told in the Blue Mountain District, again, as you'd mentioned, you're right there, of New South Wales. It scared children coming home by bush tracks from school and boys out late after lost cows, and even grown bushmen, when going alone into a lonely track after sunset, would hold their backs hollow and whistle a tune when they suddenly heard a thud of a kangaroo leaping off through the scrub. You know, it's just, it reminds me so much of some of those native traditions here in the United States of Bigfoot. And I think it's so interesting, Andrew, that there are reports from continent to continent that deal with this kind of an almost archetypal presence of a hairy man. Why do you think that is? Are there actually physical beasts, or is there something embedded in the human consciousness that we all are somewhat akin to and yet we can't explain?
Look, I actually think that it may be a bit of both, actually. I do think that if there isn't now, that there definitely, well, I could never say definitely, but that there probably was one of these or more of these creatures living, you know, in the Blue Mountains and across other parts of Australia. But I think there is definitely a flesh and blood component to these creatures.
I tend to think so, too. And yet, there are these strange reports about these creatures, especially in the United States. From time to time, they'll even vanish into thin air and do other strange, inexplicable things that the Fortean researchers like to refer to as high strangeness. Now, going down under in Australia, you know, I take into consideration the ways that, you know, geomagnetic effects of the Earth could literally have a different kind of influence on certain parts of the world than in others. What my question would be along the lines of this high strangeness phenomenon often associated with strange creatures and things like this is, do those sorts of reports also occur in Australia where a creature like a hairy man or a cryptozoological beast literally just vanishes into thin air and the witness is left trying to reconcile with whether what they saw was physical or maybe something else? Do you guys have those kinds of reports down under as well?
I haven't looked into too much of that at the moment. From the early reports that I've more concentrated on, it does seem to be not so much, you know, high strangeness associated with it, but just actually, you know, encountering these creatures in the wild. So I'm sure there is some high strangeness component. Probably with the book that I've just brought out, I tend more to concentrate on some of the earlier encounters in that. But I think also some of it may be too that with these creatures living in the wilderness, what we may perceive as just the fact that it's able to basically disappear into the bush without us kind of knowing where it's gone. I did have one personal encounter in the probably just about a 10-minute walk from where I actually live, where I was walking along this track and all of a sudden I heard this, you know, thud, thud, thud footsteps. He definitely wasn't a kangaroo because I've come across plenty of kangaroos while I've been out walking. This was something different to me. It sounded like something bipedal, and it took about three steps and then it stopped. And I had this really eerie sense that something was watching me. But the thing was, it actually wasn't too far away, and I actually didn't see anything, so I kind of wasn't really looking too hard either. I really didn't want to see anything, but I just kind of slowly turned around and walked away, but just still with this really eerie sense of something watching me. So I can see how some people might see something large and hairy in the bush one second and then it's gone the next, and I think that there could be a high strangeness component to that, but I think there's probably a lot of instances where, because it's living in the bush all the time and it's probably fairly well camouflaged anyway, that it seems to us like it's, you know, there 1 minute and gone the next, where it's probably just kind of, you know, disappeared or hidden or something.
Your thought process there kind of mirrors mine, Andrew, because, you know, over the years I've looked at this phenomenon myself as being something that maybe is a little bit more than just physical. And then I look at the way that natural animals are so easily capable at times of camouflaging themselves, and they aren't able to leap into a wormhole or transmute themselves into some sort of a physical state that is invisible to us, but nonetheless somehow present and you know, capable of influencing the environment. Often I think that trying to deal with the seemingly inexplicable, we come up with these almost, almost absurd interpretations of what must be going on. And when we're dealing with something that is so, well, for lack of a better term, alien, I think that often we find ourselves coming up with even more ridiculous explanations just to try and reconcile with the oddities that are apparently there and present with us. Now, when it comes to these cryptozoological creatures, The Yowies, the Yahoo, those are interesting to me. Tell us about the Bunyip. How does it differ? What kind of a creature is that? Because I hear reports of a swamp monster and sometimes something that's almost more like a lake monster, and then at times maybe something that's a little bit different. Maybe there are varying interpretations, but what is a Bunyip exactly?
The Bunyip was originally an animal in the Aboriginal traditions, but the funny thing is with the Bunyip is that not even the Aboriginals have a consensus on what this creature is. So, you know, you'll have one tribe in one district talking about it being covered in feathers and having the head of an emu and being as large as a hippopotamus. And then in another area, you'll have descriptions that are just completely different. So I think there's as many different descriptions of Bunyips as there has been supposed sightings over the years. But my hunch is that the stories of the Bunyip have maybe been passed down through thousands of years in the oral traditions of the Aboriginals. And maybe it goes back to something a lot further back with the megafauna that became extinct about 40,000 years ago in Australia. So, you know, it could be stories passed down over, you know, over generations going to when the megafauna was still living in Australia.
I've wondered about that idea also. Maybe what you would liken to being a cultural memory that some of the Aboriginal tribes have maintained over the years, or even something that's partially comprised of an actual oral tradition that dates back several hundreds of years or longer. To when there might have been instances, although sparing, you know, instances of these sorts of large animals still existent there on Australia. And in addition to creatures and monsters and things like that, I'd like to come back around and talk about UFOs again here in a moment. But first, you also in Weird Australia, and that's a book we're talking about here, folks. If you haven't got it yet, it's available on Amazon.com. Weird Australia by Andrew Nicholson. He's got a website of the same name, weirdaustralia.com, and Andrew is our guest tonight. You know, Andrew, you talk in that book about poltergeist activity that has occurred down under just as well. What kind of poltergeist phenomena have you investigated?
Poltergeist cases really fascinate me because there's generally quite a few witnesses, and it lasts over a certain time. So it's not like one person sees a UFO fly through the sky or one person sees a yow in the bush. These are cases where multiple people, sometimes, for example, in 1921, which was a town in the Northern Tablelands of New South Wales, and there was a house that was supposedly haunted where there were stones being thrown at the house from nowhere, and stones falling inside the house, and it all seemed to centre around this particular family's young daughter, Minnie. But in that case, there was basically all the townspeople witnessed the same phenomena at the house, and including the local police constables. And so you've got quite a lot of witnesses to this one case, and I think that's something that really fascinates me, and I think it's something that definitely deserves a lot more attention than what it really gets.
I would agree. I would certainly agree. You know, those multiple witness sightings are always fascinating, and that has to bring to mind, of course, the obvious question here. Andrew, you know, have you experienced anything of that nature yourself? Have you been a witness to anything maybe that you would call ghostly or otherwise anomalous in nature?
Yeah, I haven't seen anything ghostly, I must say, but apart from a couple of weird experiences I've had in the bush, like the one I described earlier, I did see a UFO when I was in fifth class back in, funnily enough, 1978, which was the same year that Frederick Valentich went missing and the Kaikoura lights occurred. So what happened in my case, it was a fairly unremarkable sighting, but I was sitting in class. Our teacher was reading a book to us, and I was sitting next to my mate and another mate on the other side, and one of my friends just nudged me and pointed out the window, and I looked out the window, and it's, at the time there was just the three of us that were facing that particular window, and I happened to look out the window and then look across at my two friends, and they were watching the same thing, but it was just a typical flying saucer-shaped object that was just seemed to be floating effortlessly through the sky. That's pretty much the only real sighting I've had.
You know, but that's the one that so many people go their entire lives hoping to have, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And the funny thing is about it, and I told Ben and Aaron this as well, is that we saw this object, and because we actually got quite a good look at it, because with the classroom, the whole wall was just kind of one large window, so you could actually see it for kind of cross from basically one side of the classroom to the other. And it was just before recess or lunchtime, and after we had the sighting, we went out to lunch, started playing in the playground, and we didn't mention the sighting to each other. And we never ever spoke of it again. So it's, and I'm not sure why that is, but
that's so strange. Because I'll point out here, years ago I interviewed a city councilman here in my hometown of Asheville, North Carolina, and my cohort, Joshua Warren, who was in studio with me when we were doing the interview, asked him if he'd ever had an encounter of his own, and the city councilman said, you know, now that you mention it, and then he told us this incredible story about seeing a dimly orange or reddish illuminated saucer hovering over the road. He and his partner had seen it, and, they'd gone home, and she had described to him the same thing that he had described to her, and they wrote it down and made notes about it. And then after that, they didn't think about it a whole lot. And so often when people have these experiences themselves, they tend to react in that way in which they seem to have had an encounter of some sort, or they have had some sort of an experience, and then they just kind of let it go. When people ask me, Mike, have you had experiences? Have you had strange things happen? 10 times out of 10, almost, I will tell you no. And I was doing an interview with Mike Cleland a while back, and he asked me that, and I said, certainly, I've never had anything. 10 out of 10 times, I guarantee I'm the most boring guy in the world. Then he asks me about synchronicity, and I said, that happens to me all the time. And he says, no, wait a minute, Mike. Wait a minute. You have synchronicity happen all the time, and yet you say that you have never had an unexplainable experience. And maybe those coincidences mean something just as well. And speaking about that as well, in your research, I find that people who pursue this sort of stuff often end up finding that they are being pursued, whether it be by, creatures or UFOs or men in black or who knows what else. Or maybe it's just, the laws of the universe, and the universe seems to be kind of throwing things in their way that are kind of giving them like breadcrumbs, cosmic breadcrumbs, if you will, that lead them in the directions they're supposed to go. Have you, Andrew, experienced that kind of phenomenon where synchronicity or otherwise meaningful coincidences just sort of erupt into your life?
I've had a number of smaller kind of coincidences, especially over the last probably 12, 18 months or so. Nothing that I would point out as being spectacular or anything like that, but I guess it's just quite a few small things that have probably led me to where I am today.
That just so often seems to be the case, that we're almost led along at times by various things that we initially begin to pursue. Now, something, of course, that I've been pursuing for a long time is ufology. You mentioned the 1978 Valentich disappearance, but there was another incident that began to occur in December of 1978. I hope I'm pronouncing this right. It was the Kaikoura Lights. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was in New Zealand.
Ah.
And to me, that's... to me, it's probably the standout UFO case, because we do have really good footage from the case. We have expert witnesses in not only the pilots, but we have radar confirmation. And again, this happened over several nights, so it wasn't just the one experience. And I actually remember as a young boy seeing the film footage on the news at the time. And initially, it was around the end of December, there was some lights in the sky reported around the Kaikoura area of New Zealand. And I think it's just on the South Island, just across from Wellington, I think. And so based on these sightings, a Channel 10 news team from Melbourne, Australia, went across and went on a flight to trace the original flight. And so they were just planning on doing a reenactment of what had happened the previous night. And they ended up having a their own experience seeing this UFO and actually got some really good footage. So, and the footage was later looked at by Dr. Bruce Maccabee, and he came to the conclusion that it was, in fact, genuine footage.
Wow. You know, it's interesting when one of those kind of UFO cases comes together. There have been a few in the United States, but, you know, it's so often overlooked here, especially in the western part of the world, that these sorts of things do happen occasionally in other parts of the world. And I think, personally, along with that incident that you just described, that the Valentich disappearance is possibly, you know, again, one of the most compelling UFO cases. Maybe more UFO researchers here in the Americas and in Britain should look to Australia for answers to what's going on. And that being the case, have there been any other really high-profile UFO encounters that have occurred down in Australia over the last few years?
There was one which I want to look into a lot more for probably a future article for weirdaustralia.com, is the Gosford UFO sightings, which I think originally occurred in 1994 or 1998. I'm not 100% sure there, but and then there were some further sightings. But these sightings took place. Gosford is on the central coast of New South Wales, just to the north of Sydney, so it's a fairly well populated area, and there's a lot of bays and harbours, what have you, around. So a lot of people reported seeing this strange object hovering over the water and actually sucking up water into this craft. And it was fairly widely reported. So a lot of people called in. There was some the police got involved. So there's quite a bit of good documentation on that one, so I'm kind of looking forward to sinking my teeth into that one over the next month or two.
So if extraterrestrials, were they just dropping by for a drink in that instance?
They could have been. Would have been very salty water, but who knows what they...
You know, so often it seems that that's the case with UFO researchers. Who knows what they were really trying to do? But I think it's pretty clear what you're trying to do here, Andrew, and we appreciate your work. I've seen some blogs. You're now writing some for Mysterious Universe as well, I see, correct?
Right, yeah. It's which is good fun, actually, because with Weird Australia, I kind of... I had some very clear, guidelines in mind for what I wanted to write about. So now doing some writing for Mysterious Universe, I can actually branch out a bit further and look a bit further afield than Australia. So, yeah, it's great. I'm having a lot of fun doing that.
Well, you're doing a fine job with it just as well. And, of course, we also want to make sure that people do check out the website, www.weirdaustralia.com. And, of course, it's got all different kinds of things. If you've ever wanted to know anything about the strange and the unusual as it pertains to the outback of Australia, that's the place to find it. And of course, his new book is of the same title, Weird Australia, which deals with real reports of uncanny creatures, strange sightings, and extraordinary encounters. You can find it on Amazon.com, and of course, I'm sure through WeirdAustralia.com. Anything else that I've left out there, Andrew, if you'd like to pass along to the listeners of the Graylian Report tonight?
No, I think we've covered it quite well. I just wanted to give you a big thanks for all the support that you've given me over the last few months in particular, and especially to the likes of Ben and Aaron at Mysterious Universe and the guys at Anomalous.com, who originally started posting my articles up on their great website. And if it hadn't have been for Anomalous, then, you know, I'd probably still be writing blogs for, you know, 10 or 12 people on the weekends. Yeah, I just wanted to thank you guys for helping me out.
Well, absolutely. You know, the Anomalous, they're fantastic people. Melanie and, of course, Patrick Weege, you know, they're good friends of the Graylian Report. And, of course, they're, I think, really good friends to the 4TN community at large. And as a final word, I'll also tell people, if you're familiar with the Graylian Report, all you got to do to find this book at the Graylian Report is right there in the center column at the top of the page. You'll see Weird Australia. Click that. It'll take you right to Andrew's website where you can find out more about Weird Australia. We got you a good link right there at the top. Hard for people to miss. They should be able to find the website there. Andrew Nicholson of Weird Australia, thank you so much for joining us tonight as a guest on the Grayling Report, and I hope you'll come back again real soon, okay?
Thanks a lot, Micah. It's been a pleasure, and I'd love to come back soon.
Well, we're certainly going to have him back on the program again in the near future, Andrew Nicholson. And for those who are already there at the website, all you have to do is just look there in the center column near the top of the page, right underneath the PayPal donate button, Weird Australia. That will link you directly with his website, and you can learn about all the weird news and anomalistics going on way down under. Fascinating stuff. When we come back, you know what? We may just have enough time. We could open the phone lines a little bit. We'll go ahead and put those telephone numbers out there, or visit there at the Grayling Report website, the podcast and radio page. You'll find all that information. If anyone wants to call in with anything, we might do that in the last segment. Otherwise, we'll go straight to the news. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Grayling Report. Stay with us.
Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Grayling Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grayling Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Thank you, John Anderson. Always great to hear the voice of the mountains. This is, of course, the Grayling Report. Yes, from the high mountains of Appalachia, or hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth. We always like to call it the Grayling Report, your dark little corner of the web. And those are the ways that you can reach the program, 828-398-4886 or Skype ID Grayling Report if you'd like to join the program. Got just a few minutes, might be able to fit in one or two calls. Otherwise, we've got a few things in the news we're going to continue to try and carry up with. I saw that DailyGrail.com linked one of those stories about Ray Kurzweil, who plans to create a mind with Google. But maybe the World Wide Web is already functioning something like a mind. You know, Caleb, I often think about this myself. When it comes to the way that the internet, literally is becoming kind of a repository for all human knowledge, at what point does an information system that has all the information humankind can muster at its disposal, at what point does that just wake up and start utilizing that? Think about it. You know, we're literally... Think about how you take your computer and you need backup space, and so you get an external hard drive and you start moving files onto the external hard drive. The internet has become our external hard drive, and humankind, we're taking our technology from right up here, in the gray matter between our ears, and we're putting it out there. We're transferring that into that intangible data cloud, a bundle of neuristors that half the time is communicating wirelessly. It's just fascinating. The information is literally flowing via Wi-Fi systems all around you and I, wherever we are around the globe, and connecting us. And you may be on the other side of the world. We just spoke with Andrew Nicholson all the way from Australia. And the wonders of the World Wide Web, it not only allows us to connect with each other and exchange information, but it stores that information. It will store this podcast and keep forever this information, at least until some cataclysmic electromagnetic pulse event occurs. It will keep this information and store it forever so that people can access and listen to that and enjoy that, or hate it, We hope you enjoy the Graylian Report. If you do, of course, you can always go over and you can comment on iTunes and give us a rating. Tell us how much you like this podcast. We would certainly appreciate that. But it's just fascinating to me the way that the web works and the way that we are literally transferring ourselves. I have to wonder, at what point will the web actually wake up? And I mean, when is the web going to become conscious? Will it?
And in what form will it take? I would imagine with the popularity of the grumpy cat, at this point, it will manifest as a giant grumpy cat.
It's kind of like at the end of Ghostbusters, right? You know, choose the destroyer. You know, and it's not the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, it's the grumpy cat from Facebook. You know,
doesn't sound too far off.
I liked the grumpy cat today. I did. You can find him on Facebook. I liked the grumpy cat. There are a lot of those popular memes and things, man. I avoid them like the plague. I don't go liking grumpy cats all that often. But I liked the grumpy cat. He is hilarious.
He's quite funny.
He's a funny little guy. I like him. He's interesting. Here's another interesting story that caught my eye. Identical twins marry identical twins. And get this. One of the two twin couples gave birth to identical twins. Isn't that interesting?
It was very bizarre.
Yeah. And when you get into some of those reports, you know, it was believed there for a while at one point that that there had actually been experimentation with twins going on down there in Argentina. Some thought that Josef Mengele, the angel of death, had actually gone down to Argentina following the Second World War and was conducting experiments because of this incredibly high rate of twins being born down in Australia. I thought that was very interesting. You hear about that same sort of stuff. You know, we've got some good friends that are twins, Bryn and Abby Roberts, up in Minneapolis, St. Paul area. And when I'm talking to the two of them, I always like to tell people that, you know, when Abby and Bryn are there and they're talking at the same time, I feel like it's really one person talking. It's really kind of fascinating. A lot of people think you and I are twins, dude.
Yeah, I was just about to bring that up. You know, in a case, we kind of are twins because we do have the same birthday.
A lot of people don't know this. The Hanks brothers actually share the same birthday, but we were born 3 years apart. How bizarre is that? Boy, talk about Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, huh? I was about to say, how weird is that? Mom!
Yeah. Yeah, Dad!
Where's the answers?
But it is fascinating, though, you know, human life. And I can't help but wonder how that will change, perhaps, in the future. It's very interesting. And I was talking about, by the way, all that barring the potential for some sort of a cataclysmic, catastrophe that may actually occur. And apparently in the 8th century, what is described as a gamma ray burst actually struck Earth, according to BBC News. Get this one. They say in 2012, researchers found evidence. Boy, it's funny that we're already referring to 2012 in the past tense, huh? But researchers found evidence that our planet had been struck by a blast of radiation during the Middle Ages and that there was debate over what kind of a cosmic event could have caused it. But now a study suggests that it was the result of two black holes, or a neutron star, merging in our galaxy. Who said two negatives can't create a positive? There you go. The age-old question has been finally determined. But you know what's interesting to me is that there are all these, if you look back through history, there are all these instances where people claim that there is evidence of, and I've written about this actually in the, The Lost Civilizations and Secrets of the Past anthology that New Page Books put out a couple of years ago. I wrote an article in that talked about the way that nuclear events are an inescapable part of our history. The majority of them would have to have been, if not all of them, natural. But I do wonder sometimes, about the potentials, especially when we look at that, the 300-million-year-old, what they're calling a UFO tooth, you know, it's like a cog or a wheel or something, you know, from an aluminum alloy found in coal in Russia. When we look at those kinds of reports and we think about those kinds of things, it really does cause us to broaden our conception, I guess, or rather at least our general idea of what our history may have entailed. It may not be everything that we think it is, and that seems to be the underlying theme here, isn't it? That just seems to be where everything is going, that every time we think we know something, every time we think we've got it all figured out, well, we're actually further from finding that truth than we thought we were. And unfortunately, we are now very close to drawing this week's edition of the Graylian Report podcast to a close. Caleb, thank you so much for all your assistance here in the tech department. Without you, this ship would not have stayed afloat.
Thank you, sir.
On behalf of all of us here at Graylian International, Matt Oakley, Chris Hayes, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Caleb Hanks, and of course your mouth of the South, Micah Hanks. We bid you adieu, my friends, and until next time, stay strange out there. We'll talk to you next week.
Of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.